looking at this thing and go, try to talk and I go blank. How's everybody doing? Can't do it. Won't be able to. Testing 1, 2, 3. You gotta be kidding. Maybe if I take a little crack at a time, we'll be okay. Where do I start? Let's see. Sitting here, it's Sunday afternoon. Just got a letter from Pops. Looks like things are all set for deer season. As far as I know, it should be back there. Things are going to be going strong over here, I'm sure, for 6 months, so there's no way in hell we're getting home early. Flying's good. Got about, I guess I told you in the letters, I got about 40 hours so far. I've only flown, I got 11 combat rides and one local area checkout ride. So going pretty strong. Not too bad. Let's see, I think I wrote Pops a letter, told him all what all we were doing over here. Figure out the, what I haven't told you. Convoys are still going strong. Sending boats up the Mekong from South Vietnam. Trying to get into Phnom Penh. Usually takes a full day. They start at sunrise, and the last boat usually makes it in around dusk. All we do is take off out of here with a full load of bombs and circle over the convoy, keep an eye on them. Get low on gas, we go up and hit a tanker once or twice and come back and circle. The most action I've seen so far is we went in after, on 11 rides, did a lot of bomb dropping, hit a couple bridges. Went in after some 51 calibers one day. Those are really sharp because when you're rolling them, you can see them shooting at you. No sweat, they can't shoot up very high anyway. We stay high enough so the bullets never reach us. Still makes your heart kind of pound. Yeah, I wasn't going to talk about the flying. What the heck? We also got truck convoys that come in from southwest, Phnom Penh, up along Route 4. And they usually take a full day, too. When the convoy starts moving, they usually spread out about 30 miles, so it takes quite a bit of coordination keeping everything quiet. They haven't been having too many problems lately. A7s are doing a good job over here, putting the bombs on the target and getting them there. And flying in and out of the weather is really sharp. Let's see. Today is Sunday, and I got the day off. And had the day off yesterday. Got kind of soused last night, so I'm glad I'm not flying today. Tomorrow we're leaving for, we got some combat time off, 5 days. And Ron Dendy, myself, Paul Rossetti, Bill Powley, and Major Hoskins are going to Singapore. Got a C-130 out of here that's going to take us down there with no charge. They just happen to be flying in there for some reason. I don't know. They'll be coming back 3 or 4 days later. So we're going to plan on pressing on down there and seeing the nightlife. Hitting the bars, probably taking a whole bunch of pictures and stuff when we get there. Should be pretty interesting. Let's see. Oh yeah, the base setup. We got the Karat Royal Thai Air Force Base here, and we're associated with them really, but we own probably 85% of the base. And our living quarters for the A7s, the TDY troops, are only over here temporarily. We're living off the Air Force base on the Thai military base, army base. Rooms aren't too bad. We got a private bathroom. There was 3 guys in a room, just the old army bunk. They're pretty comfortable beds. And we got a hooch maid, Ayo. She's 25. Not bad looking. Doesn't speak much English. And it's really amazing. She never knocks on the door. You know, all you gotta do is throw your dirty clothes on the floor and whatever shoes you want to spit shine, you just put them out there. And she comes on in the morning and picks it all up and goes on out. If we go to work, I never see her until I come back, and she's got all the clothes folded up and put in the drawers for you, and the boots are all spit shined, and really pretty good deal. Like cost $1 a day for the room and the maid and everything. So I guess you could say it wasn't too extravagant. Right across the street from where we're staying right here, we got a swimming pool, and the BX Annex has got just about anything you need. And it's got a cafeteria open 24 hours. You can get hamburgers, bacon and eggs, and Thai style. Everything tastes like Thai food. Even a hamburger tastes like Thai food. I'm going crazy. Thai food is great, but what they call American food isn't American food. It's American Thai food. It's unbelievable. I've been downtown 3 or 4 times. I got some good pictures of it yesterday. We went down for about 3 hours. Oh, you can order anything. I got a pair of boots on order now for flying. Black. Got calf leather on the bottom and elephant hide on the top. Handmade. $16. Just unbelievable. You sit there and take about 12 measurements on your foot. I guess they just fit like a glove when you get them back. And for $16, you can't go wrong. Let's see. What else have I had a party suit made. Looks like a flying suit, except it's all red and it's got a whole bunch of weird patches on it. And when the squadron throws a beer blast, everybody comes dressed like that, so we don't have to worry about getting our clothes dirty. We just let the hooch maid wash up the flight suit. Yeah, let's see. Went downtown yesterday. I said that, didn't I? What did we do? Oh, I went down with Terry Middaugh, and he was going down to buy a bike. And we ordered the bike, went around. I bought a ring, $2.50. Little pink ring. Real good deal. I think it's turning my finger green. Yeah, as a matter of fact, it is. Well, anyway, geez, they got some fantastic jewelry down here. They got more stones than you can imagine, all different sizes. Not too bad, not too expensive either. I think I'm going to wind up buying a few of that stuff, and all kinds of wood carvings. Got a lot of tailor shops and cloth. Not much good having anything made up, because when they take the measurements on you, it's got to be refitted about 3 times anyway before they get it to fit. Okay, I think I'll stand by here and replay what I said here and see if it makes any sense. Well, it doesn't sound too bad. I guess slightly unprofessional, but getting the point across. Hey, Pops, I mentioned Ron Dendy. He's the one that's going to be coming up flying with us. That's D-E-N-D-Y. He's from Alabama. I guess he does a lot of bird shooting. Hasn't been upstate New York. Hasn't even seen New York, I don't think. So hopefully we're going to get up there for 4 or 5 days. If everything turns out good with him. And well, I'm sure we'll be back, because we're only going to be TDY here. We'll be back in time for it. So shouldn't be too bad. We're kind of looking forward to it already. Let's see. Oh, I could tell you about my trip to the Philippines. Clark Air Force Base. I think we got here on the 1st or the 2nd of April. And on the 4th of April, we had had a couple of days of lectures, local area procedures and stuff, hadn't flown. And they decided they're going to start cycling the new lieutenants through the snake school over there, because of jungle survival, you know, flying over jungle and all that. So I got picked first to go. Let's see, who was it? It was, I went with Ted Winning in my squadron and Daryl Hanna out of the 354th squadron. They're from DM. They're over here. They took the place of the 356 squadron when, or rather, we took the place of the 356. They came over and the 354th replaced the 353rd the first time the 353rd was here. This is the second time our squadron's been over here. Well, anyway, we were told, I think it was a Wednesday morning. Went in for our lectures at 8 o'clock, and they said, hey, you guys are leaving at 1 in the afternoon for the Philippines. All right, so we went home, we got all dressed, got packed up. We hopped to C-141, which is a big cargo plane out of here, and they flew us straight into Clark in the Philippines, and that's the same base where all the POWs went through. There weren't any left on base, I don't think. They were all shipped off home by then. We got there, and it's kind of an interesting place. Jungle survival was unbelievable. It was really fantastic. Learned a whole bunch. They've got these people down there. They're sort of aborigines. They're called Negritos, and they're mountain people. And they were very, very important during World War II when they fought the Japanese there. And actually, the Japanese probably could have taken the island and kept it if they hadn't pissed off the Negritos, because those people were unreal. Evidently, when the Japs first took the island, they hired 7 or 8 Negritos to go up and hide all the gold that they had pilfered out of Manila. And the Negritos carried it up the mountainside, found the cave or whatever they were going to put it in, hid it, and then the Japanese shot all the Negritos. Now, right there, it was their big mistake. Those Negritos are unreal. We had practice in escape and evasion. The Negritos showed us how to... We had a six-man element that we stayed in the jungle one night after 2 days of lectures. And our Negrito was Joe. His name was Joe. Didn't speak much English, but he got... They got him away from wearing the loincloth and all that. He wears a uniform. He's a civilian. They've got a Negrito for every element that goes into the woods or into the jungle. But we went out one afternoon, and our enlisted instructor gave us about an hour and a half lecture on hiding and camouflage and that kind of stuff. And about halfway through the lecture, he sent Joe out, and he says, "You go ahead and hide." So Joe went out, hid, and about a half hour later, we heard this whistle, you know, So the instructor says, "Hey, Joe, you ready?" And Joe says, yep, ready. Okay, so we pressed on out there looking for him. And Joe had hung his knife up on the tree, so we knew where he started from. So we looked for tracks, couldn't find any tracks. And now you got to figure, there were six or eight of us in the element. We just all over that place for a half hour, all within 20 feet of him. And I think at one point I probably stepped within a foot and a half of him. One guy stepped on his foot, didn't even realize it, kept walking over him. Finally, he whistled. We were sitting there, walking around looking. He whistled. I heard the whistle. I looked, couldn't see anything. Walked up, walked over him, couldn't see him. And finally, we just had to tell him to come out. And he was unbelievable. He didn't dig or anything. He was just underneath this. Can't even explain it. He just hid himself so well, there was just no way he was going to be found. Well, anyway, that was the second day, but the first day we went out. We got took about a 45-minute truck ride up the mountainside, up into the helicopter pad, and they lifted us from the helicopter pad about 15 miles up into this high ridge line. They call it I don't know, it was a helicopter pad, and they put us out there with the packs. We only had to walk about 15 minutes until we hit the base camp. Had plenty of food. Took about a 4-hour walk in the afternoon. Now, this is unbelievable. I always figured a jungle was going to be, you know, really wet, really moist, muddy, and I think it was so dry, you wouldn't have believed it. Every time you took a step, the dust flew. It was just, the dry season, it was just amazing. It was thick. It was really thick, but it was dry, which was, you know, it was good. There weren't any bugs, very few bugs. They were rats, though. Jungle rats. And they're not the kind of rats you think of. They just happen to be rats, and they live in a jungle. They don't, you know, there's no slum area there in the middle of the jungle, but they're jungle rats, you know. And boy, those things, you're sitting there in your little tent with the mosquito net around you, and you can hear those things. They sound like an elephant coming through the woods in the middle of the night. And that's basically the reason we spent the night out there, is just to associate you with all the strange noises you can hear. And so you know, in case you ever did wind up in a situation like that, you wouldn't worry about the damn noises. You'd just press on and get yourself some water. And getting water is no problem. They took us for a walk the first afternoon, and they pointed out all the trees and water vines. Now, you know all these vines you're seeing hanging down from these trees. Well, Joe goes up and cuts one of these things, and he holds it horizontally, about a 6-foot section of it, tips it up, and clear, fluid water. Just like spring-fed water, and it's cool, comes pouring out the end. We filled up. I think we had one 30-foot section of about a 50-foot section of a vine. He climbed up a tree and cut it. And we got a whole canteen cup full. I guess that's about a pint. Might even be a pint and a half of clear water. Everybody got a taste of it. Okay. There's another vine you cut open. Drink the water out of it, and then mash it up with the butt of your knife, and it turns to soap. And it turns like into a scouring pad. Everybody washed up, and it smelled just like soap, like Baraxo or one of those type of soaps. And it cleaned good, felt like soap, and it was amazing. But then there's Joe. Now, Joe, you got to figure he's about 37, 40 years old, and he fought the Japanese when he was about 12, I guess, 15. And he can't say much. He says, if he points out something that's good to eat, he'll say good. If he points out something, that would be good for birds and not for humans, he say good for birds. And if he points out something that's really, really deadly poison, he says good for Japanese. If he says good for Japanese, you want to just stay away from it. Well, anyway, he got out this stuff he calls arrow vine. It was another water vine, but when you cut it open, it was a thick, milky fluid that came out of it. And he poured some of it out onto a leaf, and he looked at it, and he says, you boil this. Boil it until it turns black. And evidently, it turns into such a deadly poison that if you put it on the end of an arrow and shoot somebody with it, he's dead in 5 minutes. He says, you get a little cut, and you put that stuff on you, and you're dead in 5 minutes. And there's also one of the tricks he told us they use on the Japanese when they were there. They have this, it looks like a potato, but it's really poisonous. Nobody eats it. And what they would do is, when the Negritos would make camp and have, start up cooking for dinner, old mama-san there would go digging around and get one of these potatoes and put it in a pot and let it boil right next door to where she was cooking everything else. And they cook it all in sections of bamboo. They make pressure cookers out of bamboo. We learned how to do that. And you can cook rice in half the time. Well, anyway, they'd leave this old tuber there boiling on this pot. And if they got word that the Japanese were coming, they'd abandon the camp, take all the good food, and leave the pot there, The old Japs would come by and say, not bad. They cooked dinner for us, Heck, if the Negritos can eat it, so can we. And actually, it didn't really kill them. It just knocked them all, stunned them all. And I guess they'd, in about 20 minutes, the Negritos would come back and just bop them over the head with a club. Didn't want to waste the arrows, I guess. And took care of the Japanese. Which I guess is a pretty good setup for them. The whole area is unbelievably covered with old helmets, old bones, old knives, old guns. There's a couple of downed aircraft up in there. And whatever. What else did we do that was really interesting there? I never saw any animals. I did see one rat. I had a flashlight out. I saw a little rat or a mouse. Might even have been a round mouse. I don't know. It looked more like the size of an elephant. But that was it. There weren't any snakes. They told us all about snakes and how to handle them, but never saw one. And that was about it. We just had that hiding exercise. The sec got up the next morning and had breakfast and had the lecture on E&E or escape and evasion and camouflage and hiding. And then we hid for 2 hours. And that was an experience. They set us up at a base camp and they said, okay, press. And they gave us a half hour to hide. And they hire these little Negritos. These are actual mountain people, and all they're doing is they're wearing loincloth, And you're all given two dog tags that are plain, nothing written on them. And you hide. And when these Negritos come by, they're making all kinds of whoop whoop noises and everything, trying to scare you, And you sit there and hide. And they come up and they catch you. They make a weird noise. Whoop whoop. I can't even duplicate it, but. If they grab you, you hand them a chit, and then they go away, and they turn the chits in for a pound of rice at the end of the exercise. So I learned, you learn quite a bit. You have the actual Negritos, the kind of people you'd be running into. They'd be looking for you in the woods or in the jungle. I just learned a super bunch. And we had a good time. When we'd start 6:30 in the morning every morning, but get off at 3 o'clock, so we had the whole afternoon with the club, and went downtown to a couple of clubs, and it wasn't too bad. The town that Clark is situated in, called Angeles City, is under martial law. The Philippines is under martial law. I don't know if you remember back a few months ago where the president's wife was attacked with that knife, you know, and she took about 80 stitches or 100 stitches, and they killed the attacker. Well, that started the martial law right there, and they got curfews, and there's a guy with a shotgun in every corner, and it gets kind of tense going downtown, but I thought it was interesting and enjoyed it. Well, anyway, we got back from there around the 8th, I guess, 8th or 9th of April, and started flying. I flew straight. I don't think I had a day off. Well, if I had a day off, we went on to alert. First off, I had my first ride. It was a three-ship ride. We took off, and we just toured all the military bases, flew all the military bases in Thailand to check out the, in case of diverts and all that, we'd know what the place looked like. And it was really a waste of time, but it was enjoyable, get us back in the swing. And the very next day, we went out on a combat ride, and that's... combat rides that we're flying now are two-ship rides. We have a flight lead and me. And we carry two external tanks, which adds 3,000 pounds to the plane, full of fuel. And then we carry either six. Our squadron now is carrying either six Mark 82s, which is 500-pound bombs, or four Mark 83s, which is a 1,000-pound bomb, or they're carrying four CBU 52s, which are a little, it looks like a big bomb, except when it comes off the plane, the bomb breaks open and all 300 or 400 little tiny bomblets, like super duper size hand grenades, come out. It's kind of an anti-personnel type thing. They use it for troops in contact, and they go after guns with it on the ground. Instead of being a pinpoint target, it'll spread out depending on how you release it and when you release it. It'll spread out anywhere from 300 or 400 yards. Just kind of cleans the area out. And that's what we're flying with. The Sandy Hobo Squadron, which is the permanent, there's a PCS squadron over here. They're here for a year, and they're flying A-7s. And their primary mission is search and rescue in case an aircraft would go down and the pilots would be down on the ground, that these A-7s would go in and coordinate the rescue and keep the ground fire down while the helicopters came in and got you out. And you guys are unbelievably super people. They carry different types of ordnance for the specific type of job they have to do. As I say, our rides are, if we're not going on convoy escort, we usually have a two-hour ride. We take off out of here, fly over toward Ubon, which is southeast of here, still in Thailand. And Ubon has a GCA controller on the ground, a radar controller, and we come up with him. They call him Lion. That's his call sign. So we get a hold of Lion, and Lion tells us, okay, radar contact, you're clear, and he gives us traffic advisories in case there's other aircraft in the area. They kind of help you avoid mid-air collisions and stuff, because there's a lot of planes flying around. Anyway, we get in touch with an airborne controller after that, which is called Cricket, which is a C-130 that's airborne 24 hours a day. Well, they, different planes, but they're always up there. And what he is, they've got the big birds up there, the colonels and the bigwigs up there, and they control the ground war and the air war, coordinate. The ground people call up to the with forward air controllers, which are small aircraft, OV-10s and O-2s, propeller jobs that fly slow and low. Ground controller gets a hold of him on the radio and says, hey, we need some help here, we're troops in contact or something, and we need some air support. The FAC calls up Cricket, which is the airborne control center command. Cricket, when we get a hold of him, tells us, hey, he says, you guys are needed down here with fax so-and-so. They give us the fax call sign, and they give us his location. We fly over there, make radio contact with the FAC, get vectored in, visual contact with the FAC, and the FAC coordinates with the ground controllers, finds out the enemy locations. He's moving a lot slower. He can see the enemy locations. And he has smoke rockets on his plane, so he rolls in and pops the smoke on the ground. So we say, yeah, we see the smoke, and he says, well, the smoke is a good smoke, it's on the target, or he says, well, it's 10 meters north of the target, or I want your bombs on my smoke, or off here, or left, right, whatever, and we go in. Okay, for now, I think I'll sign off permanent. I don't think anybody else will want to say anything. I'll just turn this off and listen up to what I said, and then that ought to do it. Okay, take care. We'll be
catching you later. Maybe I'll send you another tape, or I got a tape here in case you want to go ahead and make one back there and get everybody in on it. You know, it'd be good if you could just set the thing up at the dinner table some night and maybe not even have anybody know about it. Just, it might be interesting. Okay, I guess we'll be catching you later then. Take care, and you all be good now.